Strange studies of strange stories.
Two years earlier, Gus Kusevic had been driving slowly down the narrow back road into Boonesborough. It was good country for slow driving, particularly in the late spring. There was nobody else on the road. The woods were just blooming into a deep, rich green, as yet unburned by summer. And the afternoons were still cool and fresh. And just before he reached the Boonesborough town line, he saw the locked and weathered cottage standing for sale on its quarter-acre lot. He had pulled his road car to a gentle stop, swung sideways in his seat, and looked at it. It needed paint. The siding had gone from white to grey, and the trim was faded. There were shingles missing here and there from the roof, leaving squares of darkness on the sun-bleached rows of cedar, and, inevitably, some of the window panes had cracked. But the frame hadn't slouched out of square, and the roof hadn't sagged. The chimney stood up straight. He looked at the straggled clumps and windrowed hay that were all that remained of the shrubbery and the lawn. His broad, homely face bunched itself into a quiet smile along its well-worn seams. His hands itched for the feel of a spade. He got out of the road car and walked across the road and up to the cottage door and copied down the name of the real estate dealer listed on the card tacked to the doorframe.
Looks like Gus Kusevic just found a little gem of a cottage that nobody else seems to have noticed. A fixer-upper out in the country, and we're going to hang out with Gus as he gussies up this mid-century charmer here on Strange Studies of Strange Shanties. If you thought watching paint dry was exciting, wait until you hear it.
That opening is from the short story Nobody Bothers Gus by Algis Boudris. We're here covering it on Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
We've been doing science fiction all month, and back in August, I was kind of raking through different lists of great classic sci-fi stories to figure out what we would cover, and Nobody Bothers Gus was buried in those lists, kind of unnoticed. I gave it a read. It turned out to be exceptional, which is very in theme with the story itself. But before we get into all of that, let's talk about that exceptional reader we heard at the top.
Our reader today is none other than Paul Fricker. He is the other half of Mason and Fricker's Eldritch Stories.
Eldritch Stories is a podcast where you can hear Mike and Paul read short tales of the weird and wondrous. Paul is perhaps known to some of our listeners as the co-writer and designer of the 7th edition of Chaosium's Call of Cthulhu role-playing game.
That's right.
He's role-playing game royalty. I would say.
He sure is. And Paul also has a blog. People still do those.
Oh,
I didn't know if you knew that, but he does. PaulFricker.substack.com. Check him out.
Thank you, Paul, for joining us on the show today. Eldritch, as many of you may know, it means strange or unnatural, especially in a way that inspires fear. And while today's story on the surface almost seems like a comic book or superhero riff, I would argue that it is right in the wheelhouse of cosmic horror.
Yeah.
I read the story in a scan of Astounding Science Fiction, the November 1955 issue, which was 35 cents at the time, and has a feature story called Under Pressure by Frank Herbert of Dune fame.
Oh.
This story, Nobody Bothers Gus, appears about halfway through the issue. It's credited to an author called Paul Janvey, which it turns out is a pen name for a fella called Algis Boudris. What do we know about this Algis Boudris character?
His full name is Algirdas Jonas Boudris, and he was born in East Prussia, Germany, in 1931.
That area is today known as Kaliningrad, part of the Russian Federation.
His father was the consul general of Lithuania when Boudris was born, but when he was five, his father was transferred to New York City. After the war, his family stayed in New Jersey as exiles since Lithuanian diplomats weren't recognized by the U.S. and Lithuania was at that time under the control of the Soviets.
Mm.
Boudris taught himself English by the time he was six, reading Robinson Crusoe and Flash Gordon comic strips. But it was at age 11 that he discovered Astounding Science Fiction magazine, which set him on a lifelong path to geekiness.
I'm sorry, I think you meant to say genius.
He went to college at the University of Miami and later at Columbia University in New York. His first published story was The High Purpose, which came out in 1952 in Astounding Science Fiction Stories.
He managed to publish in the very magazine that inspired him, which is pretty cool.
Boudris went on to become an editor later that year for Gnome Press and Galaxy Science Fiction. He had lots of different pen names, maybe because he was doing that trick of being an editor and not wanting to obviously publish his own stuff.
Sure.
I'm not sure if that's true. That's just a guess. He went by Frank Mason, Alger Rome, John A. Century, William Scarf, Nick Knack, Pick and Mix, Lavender Gooms, Lemongrass Guadalupe, Squirts McIntosh, Weepy Boy Santos, and in this story, as you said, Paul Janvier.
Well, I feel like some of those might not be real pen names that he used. I'm going to accept it all as truth and not just things you made up.
Okay. Boudreaux's 1960 novella, Rogue Moon, was nominated for a Hugo Award and then later put into the anthology The Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 2, in 1973. His novel, Who?, was made into a movie starring Elliot Gould in 1973. He also won the Science Fiction Research Association's 2007 Pilgrim Award for lifetime contributions to speculative fiction scholarship. In 2009, he was the recipient of one of the first three Solstice Awards presented by the SFWA in recognition of his contributions to the field of science fiction.
He received all of these accolades, and yet I haven't heard of him until now. How strange.
In his life, he published around 100 stories and 6 novels, but he was really known as a sci-fi critic, editor, and publicist. His best-known publicity stunt was erecting a giant pickle on the proposed site of the Chicago Picasso during the time the newly arriving sculpture was embroiled in controversy.
The controversy being that it wasn't a statue of some notable Chicago historical figure. The statue is still there, actually, in Daly Plaza. I believe it's supposed to be an abstract version of Picasso's Afghan hound. Mm-hmm. Before it went up, Boudreaux put that pickle on the site on behalf of his client, Pickle Packers International, which is the most Chicago-sounding company I've ever heard. I think this might be the first author we've covered whose other career involved giant pickles, but I'll have to go through and listen to the previous 600 or so episodes we've done to see if that's true.
I'll check that out.
I'll go give a quick listen.
He lived in Evanston, Illinois at the end of his life, and he died in 2008. At the age of 77, survived by his wife and 4 sons.
All right.
As you said, Nobody Bothers Gus was first published in Astounding Science Fiction in 1955, edited by John W. Campbell.
Campbell was the man.
So our story begins with our protagonist, Gus, finding a rundown house out in the middle of nowhere and deciding that he wants to make it his own. He's excited to get to work and to get his hands dirty.
We immediately jump ahead 2 years. It looks like he's gotten his wish. The cottage belongs to him, and he's working on the lawn.
He's hoping to get this done in time to catch the last half of the Giants and Kodiaks game. He likes sports.
This particular game that he wants to catch, there's a player pitching for the Kodiaks called Halsey that he wants to see. And the Giants, that's a real franchise. That's San Francisco's team. I don't know if there's a Kodiaks or if there ever has been. In Major League Baseball. So I could be wrong, but that was sort of my first indication this might be some alternate 1950s present, or maybe it's set in the future, because that right. I'm like, that team's made up.
Pretty soon here, just as he's about to finish up, a battered flivver, which means cheap aircraft, sets down, and it sounds like it's a helicopter the way it's described, but is this some sort of future vehicle?
It's gotta be, because it flies up and kind of, as far as I can tell, lands right in front of his house. Mm-hmm. So I think that flivver at the time would have meant a junky car, kind of like a jalopy, which I learned in Archie Comics or Hoopty. I think it's some kind of futuristic Jetsons-y kind of vehicle.
And he also says that it sets down quietly, which doesn't sound like a helicopter, because helicopters, especially in the 1950s, made a hell of a lot of noise.
Right.
So it must be either the near future or some kind of alternate 1950s. But the sign of the vehicle reads, Falmouth County Clerk's Office.
I was always hyped for flying cars when I was a young science fiction fan, but then as you become a driver,
oh my God, no way.
That concept becomes absolutely terrifying. Drivers are already bad, and now you're going to add up and down to this equation.
Yeah, flying cars are a terrible idea. Now the craft sets down, and a skinny guy in a suit comes out to greet Gus, and we get a description of Gus here.
Gus was a big man. His shoulders were heavy and broad. His chest was deep, grizzled with thick, iron-gray hair. His stomach had gotten a little heavier with the years, but the muscles were still there under the layer of flesh. His upper arms were thicker than a good many thighs, and his forearms were enormous. His face was seamed by a network of folds and creases. His flat cheeks were marked out by 2 deep furrows that ran from the sides of his bent nose, merged with the creases bracketing his wide lips, and converged toward the blunt point of his jaw. His pale blue eyes twinkled above the high cheekbones that were covered with wrinkles. His close-cropped hair was as white as cotton. Only repeated and annoying exposure would give his body a tan,
but his face was permanently browned. The pink of his body sunburn was broken in several places by white scar tissue. The thin line of a knife cut emerged from the top of his pants and faded out across the right side of his stomach. The other significant area of scarring lay across the uneven knuckles of his heavy-fingered hands.
We get that Gus is an older guy, white-haired, scarred, and worn. His history shows on his body. Gus is also a bit intimidating, and he knows it, so he tries to smile to put this guy at ease. The man asks if he's Mr. Kasevic, and Gus says, yes, what can I do for you? And he's got a notice from the county council. It's pretty hot outside, so Gus invites him in for a beer.
The guy says, you know, all I've got to do is deliver this. And Gus can see that he's a little more confused by the contrast between Gus and the house, which is very white picket fence, charming.
Yeah.
If this was a real estate show, this would be the final product that they reveal at the end.
Yeah.
He was obviously much more taken up by his effort to equate Gus with the rose arbor, the neatly edged and carefully tended flower beds, the hedges, the flagstoned walk, the small goldfish pond under the willow tree, the white-painted cottage with its window boxes and bright shutters, and the curtains showing inside, the sparkling windows. So he has really knocked it out of the park with this house rehab, even though he looks like a big longshoreman, who wouldn't be living in a place like this.
Gus smiled, it's my home. A man likes to live in a nice place. In a hurry? And the guy says, well, not really. So I'll take you up on that beer.
Now, if somebody dropped down out of the sky to deliver something to me, I'd probably want to know what was in the package right away. But you get the sense that more than that, Gus just kind of wants some company. He's lonely. Yeah.
They go inside and Gus gets a beer, and he notices the man looking at Gus's large library of books. The clerk was too painfully mystified that a grown man would fool with books, particularly a man like Gus. Now, one of these kids that messed with college politics, that was something else. But a grown man oughtn't act like that.
Oh, man, screw this guy.
Gus was hoping for some good conversation from his unexpected guest, but he can see that this guy is just basic.
Yeah, yeah.
But since Gus is feeling a bit lonely, he figures why not try and talk to him anyway.
He gives him a beer. They do some small talk. It says the man seemed to be considerably ill at ease, probably because of the notice he'd brought, whatever it was. Gus found himself wondering what it could possibly be, but now that he'd made the mistake of giving the man a beer, he had to wait politely until it was finished before he could talk. He asks the guy if he's a baseball fan and switches on the Giants Kodiaks game that he'd been wanting to watch. Man clearly is a baseball fan, says sure. And, you know, he seems more comfortable with sports than with all these books on the bookcase.
Gus points out that they have a great pitcher, Halsey, and the clerk shrugs and says, well, Walker's the best, actually. And Gus gets annoyed with this, but then he remembers the clerk wouldn't notice Halsey.
The clerk wouldn't pay much attention to Halsey, naturally. I mean, that's our first indication of why Gus might be interested in this pitcher, Halsey. There's some quality they share, maybe?
Mm-hmm. He asks the clerk what Halsey's record was last year, but the clerk can't remember. He focuses on how great Walker is. But he gets some of the facts wrong, and Gus knows it.
The man is actually attributing a bunch of Halsey's achievements to this guy, Walker, the other pitcher, without realizing that he's even done it. When Gus tells him he's got his stats wrong, he says, say, I think you're right. Huh. Now, what the Sam Hill made me think Walker was the guy. And you know something? I've been talking about him all winter, and nobody once called me wrong. The clerk scratched his head. Now somebody pitched them games. Who the dickens was it? So he just, like, cannot remember Halsey.
Gus watches the TV, and Halsey is striking out the other players. He notes, he threw himself into the game with all the energy and enjoyment a man felt when he realized he was at his peak. And that, out there on the mound in the sun, he was as good as any man who ever had gone before him in this profession. Gus wondered how soon Halsey would see the trap he'd set for himself. He thinks about Halsey as if he knows him, or at least can relate to him, and he knows that Halsey can't lose. And if you can't lose, can you really win?
For Halsey, it was just a complicated form of solitaire that always came out right. I used to use a line jokingly, like when we were in Vegas, I'd go, I don't know how to lose. I just don't know how to do it. But in this case, that's actually right.
Yeah.
Halsey cannot lose.
Halsey'd realized there wasn't a game on earth that he couldn't beat, whether it was physical contest, organized and formally recognized as a game, or whether it was the billion-triggered pinball machine called society. What then, Halsey? What then? And if you find out, please, in the name of whatever kind of brotherhood we share, let me know. So there is definitely some connection going on between Gus and Halsey.
I think it's becoming clear that both of them have this power in which they can't lose at things, or they're just effortlessly exceptional at whatever they put their mind to, like the decorating of this house.
The clerk says he'll have to look up the facts about the pictures in his record book when he gets home. Yes, you can, Gus commented silently. But you won't notice what it says, and if you do, you'll forget it and never realize you've forgotten. So Gus and Halsey have some kind of superpower, and part of that superpower is that people don't notice them or don't remember them.
That's the rub. These guys are the best at everything, but that power comes with the side effect that they are supernaturally unnoticeable, which that's kind of an amazing concept.
Yeah.
In the issue of Astounding Science Fiction, the little blurb before the story says, nobody was angry at Gus and nobody was afraid of him or tried anything. They just didn't. Let's see. Who are we talking about? So the blurb writer of this, you know, is kind of a little meta comment on the story, which I thought was clever.
Yeah.
And there's an illustration of a referee there holding up a boxer's hand in the middle of a ring. And this boxer's clearly won a bout, but his face is all formless and indistinct. Mm. So keep that in mind for later.
Yeah. The clerk asks about one of the books by Miller. Says he heard it was good.
I suppose it is, Gus answered truthfully. I read the first three pages once, and having done so, he'd known how the rest of it was going to go, who would do what when, and he'd lost interest. The library had been a mistake, just one of a dozen similar experiments. If he'd wanted an academic familiarity with human literature, he could just as easily have picked it up by browsing through bookstores, rather than buying the books and doing substantially the same thing at home. He couldn't hope to extract any emotional empathies, no matter what he did. When he says Miller, I'm guessing that the author being referred to is Henry Miller, mm-hmm. who wrote some pretty form-breaking, kind of surrealist books that are very famous, like Tropic of Cancer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like, if you've ever read one of those, how could you possibly extrapolate what the work is going to be about from the first three pages? This is a crazy superpower that enables you to even do, I mean, he can even excel at guessing what literature is about.
Sure. It seems like he is not just physically better than people. He's mentally better than people. He's super smart. He's super physically fit and strong. And at this point, I was wondering, is Gus an alien posing as a human? It says, the trappings of culture were a bulwark of sorts. Even though it was a learned culture and not one felt, and meant no more to him than the culture of the Incas. Try as he might, he could never be an Inca, nor a Mayan or an Aztec or of any kind of kin, except by the most tenuous of extensions. But he had no culture of his own. So it sounds like he's not an alien, but he's some kind of human aberration, maybe a mutant.
He's alienated from his human brethren, but he's not from outer space. No. We don't think, no.
Because he would have like an alien culture then.
Yeah, exactly. He's just got no culture because there's nobody he can relate to except maybe this guy on TV.
Mm-hmm. Gus watches Halsey on the TV throw a ball to be hit. And when it does, he doesn't even react. So Gus can see that he's intentionally throwing the ball so this guy can hit it.
Yeah, he's not striking out everybody.
That was the first symptom, when you didn't bother to be subtle about your handicapping anymore.
Well, enough with the game. The visiting clerk finally gets to business.
The clerk hands Gus a letter and then apologizes. Gus reads the letter, and it turns out they're building a highway right through Gus's house. The clerk says that they'll pay, and pay big. Ask for any price, and they'll pay it.
It says Gus got what he meant. 12-lane highways aren't built by anything but national governments. This highway is for a greater purpose than just access or infrastructure, you know, or just routine suburbanization.
Yeah.
The fact that it's going to connect Hollister and Farnham is somehow significant to Gus.
So Gus is bummed out, of course, about losing his home, and he considers lashing out at the clerk, but he doesn't, and he asks him his name. Harry Danvers. And then Gus says, well, Harry, suppose I told you I could stop that highway if I wanted to. Suppose I told you that no bulldozer could get near this place without breaking down, that no shovel could dig this ground, that sticks of dynamite just plain won't explode if they tried to blast. Suppose I told you that if they did put in a highway, it would turn soft as ice cream if I wanted it to, and run away like a river. Now, Harry's confused by this, and Gus asks to borrow his pen. Harry hands Gus his pen, and then Gus takes the pen, rolls it in his hand into a ball. He bounces it on the floor, grabs it again, reshapes it back into a pen, and then he etches Harry's name on it with his fingernail, and then hands it back to Harry.
This is like Superman-level stuff. But the clerk just looks at the pen without really much astonishment.
Gus asks, aren't you curious about how I did that and what I am? But poor Harry just says, nice trick. Magic takes a lot of practice, doesn't it?
Gus nodded. That's a good, sound, practical point of view, he said. Particularly when all of us automatically put out a field that damps curiosity, he thought. What point of view could you have?
Now he knows he could make them all not see him or not notice him or his house.
Right. When they come through with the highway, he could just make it so they don't see him there. Yeah. Right.
And he could stop the highway from being built. But he knows that when he dies, that this field of power, his curiosity dampener, it would stop. I don't know how he knows this, but he does. And then once that would happen, there would be all this stuff that nobody noticed before and is all of a sudden there. And that would prompt an investigation. And would people figure out that there were creatures like him, these mutants, exist? And what then? Pogrom?
Meaning that humans would track them all down and wipe them out, potentially.
Yeah.
Although given that they can't be noticed, I don't know how they would track them all down.
Right.
And he must have seen this happen in the past. Maybe he was part of something that nobody was noticing, and then when he was far enough away from it, suddenly they did. What the heck is this doing here? Mm-hmm. So he knows there are limits to this sort of power that he has, this field.
He shook his head. The humans couldn't win and would lose monstrously. That was why he couldn't leave the humans a clue. He had no taste for slaughtering sheep, and he doubted his fellows did.
Yeah, so like if he did that and they did notice and they did kind of figure it out and went after him, he and these other all-powerful people, they would just kill everybody. They just cannot be beaten.
Yeah, but he doesn't have any way to find his fellows. The only way he can is if they make themselves known, like Halsey never losing baseball. That sticks out to him. So you have to be looking out for people that stick out, but that other people don't notice.
It says he wondered if Halsey even suspected there were others like himself. He wondered if anyone had noticed him when Gus Kasevic's name had been in the papers occasionally. So we know that in the past, Gus himself has been famous for some reason, or at least made an attempt to gain notoriety.
It's the dawn of my race, he thought, the first generation. Or is it? And does it matter? And I wonder where the females are. Gus has never met a woman, and probably he's never been with a woman, being that nobody notices him.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to get somebody attracted to you when they don't notice you at all.
Or remember you. Yeah. Gus says that he just wants what he paid for the place, nothing more. And the clerk is surprised by this and says, hey, look, if it was me, I would totally milk the government. But whatever, if this is what you want.
Yes, Gus thought, you doubtless would. But I don't want to because you simply don't take candy from babies. So the Superman packed his bags and got out of the human's way.
Gus wonders what good this dampening field is really for. Like,
yeah,
how's it going to serve him ultimately? When he was young, no one remembered him. No hospitals recalled his birth. Sometimes his parents would even forget that he existed.
When young Gussie Kasevic tried to enter high school, it was discovered that he had never entered grammar school. No matter that he could quote teachers' names, textbooks, or classroom numbers, no matter if he could produce report cards, they were misfiled. And the anguished interviews forgotten. No one doubted his existence. People remembered the fact of his being and the fact of his having acted and being acted upon, but only as though they had read it in some infinitely boring book. So it's not like he completely disappears.
No.
It's just that even if there is a record of him, people just can't hold it in their minds at all.
Yeah. And if there's any physical record, like papers or files, that they get lost or misplaced because there's some sort of instinctive, like, get rid of it thing that people do subconsciously. It says he had no friends, no girl, no past, no present, no love. He had no place to stand. Had there been such things as ghosts, he would have found his fellowship there. And by the time he was a teenager, he just cut himself off from the human race. Having solved the human social equation from his dispassionate viewpoint, and caring no more than a naturalist who finds that deer are extremely fond of green aspen leaves, he plunged into physical release. He discovered the thrill of picking fights and winning them, of making somebody pay attention to him by smashing his nose. Mm. He once got in a fight and killed the man, but to his disgust, he learned that he could easily get away with it.
There was a reference to this scar on his gut, and that's obviously where it came from. It says another longshoreman had slashed him with a carton knife. Mm. So, you know, he can be hurt if people see him enough to do it.
Yeah.
But he murdered that guy and didn't get caught for it.
Finally, sports was something that he got into.
Intellectual competition being meaningless, organized sports became the only answer. Simultaneously regulating his efforts and annotating them under a mound of journalistic record keeping, they furnished the first official continuity his life had ever known. People still forgot his accomplishments, but when they turned to the records, his name was undeniably there. The dossier can be misfiled, school records can disappear, but something more than a damping field was required to shunt aside the mountain of news copy and statistics that drags ball-like at the ankle of even the mediocre athlete. Despite all that, though, it still didn't work. Just like with Halsey, people just don't seem to remember, like even when they read the stats.
So what? Did he want to talk to another person like him? Another man? No, not really. But if it was a woman, yeah, he'd be interested, but not a man.
He wants the bride of unnoticeable Frankenstein.
Now, the clerk reminds him that he's got 2 months to move out, but Gus is still thinking about other people like himself. He and his kind could recognize each other only by an elaborate process of elimination. They had to watch for people no one noticed. And Gus thinks about highways.
Yeah, this highway would run from Hollister, which was a railroad junction, to the Air Force Base at Farnham, where his calculations and socio-mathematics had long ago predicted the first starship would be constructed and launched. So since he's so good at everything, he's sort of a futurist as well. Mm-hmm. The trucks would rumble up the highway, feeding the open maw with men and material. Up there in space somewhere outside the solar system was another race. The imprint of their visits here was plain. The humans would encounter them, and again, he could predict the result. The humans would win. Kusevic could not go along to investigate the challenges that he doubted lay among the stars. Even with scrapbooks full of notices and clippings, he had barely made his career penetrate the public consciousness. So, maybe space, this extreme environment, would be good for somebody like him. But even out there, he probably couldn't lose,
Well, how could he get into space? Because he can't join the Air Force. No one would remember that they hired him, and his records would get lost.
He can't fly, so he'd still have to somehow, trick his way. He'd have to be an astronaut or something.
Right, or a stowaway, but that wouldn't work. It says, who would die so that he could live within the tight lattice of shipboard economy? Which sheep would he slaughter? And to what useful purpose in the last analysis?
I keep bringing it up, but that seems like a reference to the cold equations.
Yes.
The fact that he would be a stowaway and somebody would have to die as a result.
Because obviously space travel is meticulously measured what you're carrying because it's so important.
He's got this morality. He was disgusted that he got away with killing somebody. You would think that being kind of superior to everybody would give him a kind of ruthlessness, but it hasn't.
No.
So a lot of things that he doesn't do because somebody would have to be sacrificed for it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to do that.
He's highly moral and ethical, despite the fact that he has all this power and could do pretty much anything he wants. Now, as the clerk walks to his flivver, Gus asks him a question.
Danvers, you're a sports fan, Gus said hastily, realizing his voice was too urgent, that he was startling the clerk with his intensity.
That's right, the clerk answered, pushing himself nervously back along the seat.
Who's the heavyweight champion of the world?
Mike Fraser, why?
Who'd he beat for the title? Who used to be the champion? The clerk pursed his lips.
Ha! It's been years. Gee, I don't know. I don't remember. I could look it up, I guess.
Gus exhaled slowly. He half turned and looked back toward the cottage, the lawn, the flower beds, the walk, the arbor, and the fish pond under the willow tree. Never mind, he said, and walked back into the house while the clerk wobbled his flivver into the air. The TV set was blaring with sound. He checked the status of the game. It had gone quickly. Halsey had pitched a one-hitter so far, and the Giants pitcher had done almost as well. The score was tied at 1-1. The Giants were at bat, and it was the last out in the ninth inning. The camera boomed in on Halsey's face. Halsey looked at the batter with complete disinterest in his eyes, wound up and threw the home run ball.
That's the end of the story.
An ending which implies that Gus here used to be the heavyweight champion of the world.
Yeah.
And nobody...
Nobody remembers it.
Remembers.
Yeah.
Also a little bit of prediction, accidental prediction there, when the current heavyweight champion is Mike Frazier. Well, a couple decades later, it was Joe Frazier who was the heavyweight champion of the world. So we just predicted the name of the heavyweight champion in a couple of decades.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. But so this story I thought was great. And what a terrible side effect because, per our discussions from last month, we're all kind of craving this relevance, this thing that sets us apart.
Yeah.
What a torture to be so good at everything and yet totally unmemorable. I mean, that is cosmic horror to me.
Yeah, definitely. It's got that element to it. And one thing about the story that I think speaks to how good it is and how well it's written is that when it ended, I was annoyed.
Yes.
I got to the end and I'm like, what? That's it? I want more. Obviously, it's the right length of a short story. It's what it should be. But I was disappointed because I felt like we're just getting started with this guy. I want to know what's going to happen now. What's going to happen next? Unfortunately, I don't know if there is more. I know that he wrote a sequel to this.
Well, yeah, it was kind of hard to puzzle out with just a and I only did a little bit of research on it, but apparently there are three quote-unquote Gus stories mm-hmm. that Algis Budrys wrote. I don't think they all feature this character. There's a second one called And Then She Found Him from 1957. Gus isn't in it, but it's, I believe, about a community of 50 of these superhumans that have the curiosity damping field, and they've all gotten together in Chicago.
But there's one before it, The Peasant Girl, which was in 1956.
Well, yeah, well, the third one I have is Lost Love from 1957.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So The Peasant Girl, huh?
So maybe 55, four? This one, 56, uh-huh. The Peasant Girl, and in 1957, And Then She Found Him.
Well, I've got Lost Love as well in 1957. Mm-hmm. And Then She Found Him is, you know, goes down more of that. These people are so unnoticeable, they want to find each other so that they can kind of match up. And I think that the main character in Then She Found Him is a mutant who's been using her superpowers to steal and be a thief. And then the person that would be a perfect match with her meets her and realizes that she's kind of a threat to the human race and so has to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So it's a little sad. And then I think Lost Love has a similar, it's a teenager that has these powers. And that one's a little sad as mm-hmm. well. But I didn't hear about the other one. See, yeah. So since they don't have a definite thread, it might be hard to bundle them together. It doesn't follow like one person's storyline as much as it centers around this concept of the side effect of being a super person. There's a little bit of that in comic books where somebody, you know, you're Spider-Man and you're saving the world on the reg, and then you got to go to high school where nobody knows who you are and get picked on, and that's a sting. And I think it appeals, the reason that that's a successful kind of storyline is because it appeals to all of us who feel like we're special but nobody notices.
Yeah.
And this really digs into that idea in a pretty unique way, I think.
Yeah, totally.
So hopefully when we put this show out, people listen and then don't quickly forget about it. Maybe even talking about this has that effect. We're going to have to find out.
Yeah, we'll see. I want to thank our reader, Paul Fricker.
Yes, Paul, please check out Paul's podcast that he does with our other reader from this month, Mike Mason. And of course, that podcast is called Eldritch Stories. You can hear Mike and Paul read short tales of the weird and wondrous there. Please check it out. Also, remember, Paul's got a blog.
PaulFricker.substack.com.
And I also want to thank our patrons who make this show possible. And I'm going to start by thanking Skylar Shaw.
I'd like to thank Alex.
I'd like to thank Dane Lawrence.
Timothy Betts, thanks.
Noel Bass, thank you.
Gerard Quinn, thank you.
Athena Schwartz, thank you so much.
Joshua Hodges, thank you.
Kevin Gudusko, thank you.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Michael Clark.
You people are unforgettable.
Yes.
Your names have now been memorialized in this podcast. People will know you forever. We're going to be back with a story by Zena Henderson called The Anything Box next week. I really enjoy that
really
story.
Great story, yeah.
So I hope you'll stick with us for that one. For now, I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lack, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.